This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, December 31st, 2009. I'm Dorian Marina in New York. Today we bring you a special program, Press Freedom on the Frontlines. Stay with us. In 2009, our reporters brought you voices from across the globe, and it often wasn't easy. They work in the shadow of war, censorship, and other dangers to bring you the voices of the people most affected.
We are really afraid of Taliban in Sawat, and there is no one to talk.
In a special New Year's Eve edition, we go to Sri Lanka, Honduras, Pakistan, and the Gaza Strip to revisit some of the most compelling stories of 2009. And we speak to our correspondents about how they overcame the difficulties they faced doing their jobs.
The way the press has been generally over the last 10, 15 years in Honduras is very, very controlled.
I was beaten harshly. I was threatened. My laptops, my cameras, and my equipments were destroyed many times.
Please stay tuned for Press Freedom on the Frontlines, produced by FSRN's Andrew Stelzer.
Twelve months ago today, the world's eyes were on the Gaza Strip. A truce between Hamas and the Israeli government had collapsed. The Israeli military responded to rocket fire from Gaza with a massive invasion that lasted around 3 weeks. The result was well over 1,000 Palestinians killed, along with 13 Israelis. The military siege damaged or destroyed vital infrastructure and created thousands of new homeless Gazans. Free Speech Radio News was one of the only media outlets inside the Gaza Strip at the time. Our reporter, Rami Amagari, a resident of Gaza City, was bringing us on-the-ground reports throughout.
The medical staff here have been targeted. 5 ambulances have been hit, and 3 firefighters also have been hit.
I swear they have left nothing. Either our house, a farmland, or livestock. They have left nothing.
There are no refuge, no shelters for the population, for the refugee population here.
We don't have shelter for the children. We don't have blankets for the children. We don't even have milk for the children. This is unfair.
Although the Israeli military withdrew on January 21st, the results for the people of Gaza were devastating, and the fallout continues to this day.
45,000 children need to be treated from PTSD, yes, even more.
Hiba Hamad, a 10-year-old girl, witnessed Israeli soldiers killing 3 of her cousins.
I saw on TV children being dragged out from under the rubble. From the roof of a house, I saw a tank dragging another tank. I also saw my 3 cousins, their martyred and mutilated bodies.
You've just been listening to some of our coverage of the Gaza Strip over the past 12 months. Rami Amagari was one of the only English-language reporters in the Gaza Strip during the Israeli invasion. And Rami joins us right now from the Gaza Strip. Rami, as a citizen in Gaza, can you reflect a bit on the difficulties of being a journalist during that time?
I given the responsibility on my shoulder as a reporter, actually, in order to keep up the voice of the voice of the Palestinians voiced here, simply because of the fact at that particular time of the war that Israel prevented the access of foreign reporters into the region, into the Gaza Strip, which would mean that the Israelis didn't want the situation under the war to be disseminated, to be shown off to the outside world. So the double responsibility for me was to keep up reporting despite all the hardships during the time of the war, doubled with my responsibility as a father of 4 children who had to care about these children, have had to try to ensure some kind of safety, some kind of protection for them within my own capabilities, my own capacity as an independent reporter who just depending on himself, being a freelance journalist, a freelance reporter, I had limited ability to move from place to another. I don't have a shield car. I don't have anything that might protect me from Israeli bullets or something like that during movement. Actually, I can say that I had to risk my life because I had a responsibility to keep the Palestinian story reported to the outside world.
We've been speaking with Rami Al-Magari, our correspondent in the Gaza Strip. Rami, thanks so much for your great work this year and throughout the years with Free Speech Radio News.
No problem at all, Andrew. You're so welcome.
2009 also saw the end of Sri Lanka's 25-year civil war. The Tamil Tigers, or LTTE, had been fighting for an independent state for ethnic Tamils in the northern part of the island nation. The government withdrew from the ceasefire agreement in early 2008 and considerably stepped up its military offensive in 2009. Despite pleas from the international community, the Sri Lankan government refused to slow the attack or agree to a ceasefire, and the UN estimates at least 6,500 were killed between January and April.
A quarter of a million people are reported to be caught in the conflict. Several hundred have been killed and thousands injured in the fighting.
We are shocked that the hospital was hit, and this is for the second time in recent weeks. There are also two other medical structures in that area which were all hit by shelling.
Around 200,000 people, they are sitting in a piece of land that has now shrunk to 35 square kilometers. Most of this is beach and jungle. They are sitting under pieces of tarpaulin. The rainy season has just started. There is not enough food. There is not enough clean drinking water. There is no places for people to use a latrine. There is not enough medicine. There is not enough drugs. And on top of that, there is continuous fighting all around them.
The Sri Lankan government declared victory on May 16th, but the situation for displaced civilians has been disastrous. Many have been held in camps against their will, and those that are allowed to return to their towns and villages find them either destroyed or without running water and other basic infrastructure. FSRN brought you the voices of some of the hundreds of thousands of civilians who were forced to flee their homes, many of whom remain homeless to this day.
Air Force helicopters arrived near the town of Vaunia with biscuits, noodles and rice packets. Thousands of temporary tents have been set up here. The camp is overcrowded with more than 100,000 displaced people.
When it rains, water would come inside. The bare mud floor would get wet and we couldn't sit or sleep. You couldn't go out anywhere. There's no problem getting food, but you couldn't get drinking water during the rainy days. It's very difficult to live there if it rains heavily.
We have had enough, so we don't want to come back. We have come here as we don't have any other place to go. We don't want to suffer anymore. What we want is a peaceful life and to travel freely to visit our relatives who are still in the rehabilitation centers and camps.
You've been listening to some of the stories we've heard in 2009 about the Sri Lankan government's defeat, at least temporarily, of the Tamil Tigers, or LTTE. I'm joined now by our correspondent who brought you those stories, Panaya Manakavasagam. He's been reporting for Free Speech Radio News since 2002. During the final months of the Sri Lankan government's offensive against the Tamil Tigers, there were almost no journalists in the no-fire zone and in the refugee camps. Can you give us a little insight into how you were able to continue reporting during that time, how you worked to differentiate the truth from the propaganda being put out by both the Sri Lankan government and by the rebels?
Yeah, actually, during the wartime, the fighting was taking place. It started about 20 kilometers north of Vaunia town where I live, and then it continued to a distance of about 80 to 100 kilometers. But the reporters were not allowed to even come to Vaunia town, the border town, because the government was so strict. We had some contacts in the LTTE-controlled area with the medical officials who had been working there, and we were interviewing some victims of the war, even the refugees, and we were able to just know
what is happening inside. Not the whole thing, but you know, at least a little bit of it. And also we were able to get in touch with the ICRC working in the war zone. So that also helped us. And in the meantime, we were able to get in touch with the civilians who had been brought to Vaunia Hospital with injuries. So they also related a lot of stories. That is also for a short time. After that, the government restricted the entry of journalists into the hospital as well. So it was a very difficult task for us to work and to find the truth.
And in February, you reported on the Sri Lankan government arresting a journalist because of his coverage of the conflict. Did you ever feel as a journalist that you were in danger?
Yeah, really, because the government was very good with the local reporters, especially the state media. They were supporting them, but not the others, especially the foreign journalists. I mean, even the local journalists who have been working for the foreign media had been monitored very carefully by the military. Even for me, I was under surveillance. And, you know, whenever we report, immediately they'll be questioned. How can you report that? What is your source? And also they'll try to get the details of the sources. And daily, you won't believe, even while we were working in the nights, when we hear a sound of the vehicle coming and stopping somewhere on the down the lane, so my heart will be beating because I don't know whether military people or the intelligence have come to pick me up for reporting something, or just merely suspecting that we'll be reporting adverse to the government, against the government. So that sort of nightmarish life I was living during the wartime.
You mentioned you did live right on the border of the controlled zone, and living in a Tamil-controlled area and in a country with a long-standing civil war. Have you ever had situations where you were treated differently by either one side or the other side, or that you've had trouble reporting, besides what you've already been talking about, strictly because of your background?
Yeah, because I'm a ethnic Tamil, and also the fighting was taking place between the Sinhalese majority government and the Tamil Tiger rebels. So the government and the military, they were looking at us as we were always supporting the LTTE, not as a journalist, not as a professional. So it was very difficult for us. There are about 15 journalists in our town, all are local journalists, and some of us are working for some foreign media as well. But whenever there is an incident or some dead body is brought from the war zone, that is, they give preference only for the Sinhalese ethnic reporters to go and picture and file the story and to see those things. But when we go there, at times, if we have somebody around who are known to us, because we know a lot of people, a lot of military officials who have been working for a long time and they know us and we know them, they will allow us to go there and take some pictures and cover the situation. Otherwise, you know, we'll be treated differently. They'll come to know that we are Tamils and they will say, no, you're not allowed. You'll have to get the permission from the Ministry of Defense from Colombo. That is about more than 250 kilometers from my town.
Panaya Manikavasagam is our correspondent in Sri Lanka. Panaya, thanks so much for joining us and thank you for all your work this past year.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Today we're taking a look back at 2009 and the challenges faced by FSRN reporters. Today's special, Press Freedom on the Frontlines, is produced by Andrew Stelzer. You can hear the full extended interviews with our correspondents featured on this program on our website, fsrn.org.
On the night of June 28th, Honduran President Manuel Zelaya was awoken by members of the military and forcibly taken in a plane to Costa Rica. By the time the coup d'etat was complete, Congressman Roberto Micheletti had been named president. FSRN was there throughout the aftermath.
The festive gathering turned violent when some demonstrators tried to break through a security fence and the Honduran military opened fire on the crowd. Demonstrators hurled stones at the soldiers in response, trying to escape the gunfire and tear gas. Roberto Barra, an independent reporter from Chile, was documenting a demonstration on Thursday when police attacked him with batons.
They were arresting people and we were taking photos and filming. At that moment, about 20 police came down, took my camera, hit me in the head. I'm bleeding right now. They hit me in the back, my hands, and arms. I showed them my identification, and they ripped off my credentials.
Police beat two other journalists and destroyed their equipment, but Deputy Police Commissioner Javier Leva denied any improper behavior.
At no moment did the police attack anyone. We only clear the streets if the people don't want to leave.
Zelaya attempted several times to return to Honduras and eventually snuck back in and has been protected in the Brazilian embassy since September. Honduras held presidential elections in November, but some regional governments have refused to recognize the outcome.
Police detained over 100 people, including Juan Barona, a union leader and member of the National Front Against the Coup d'État. FSRN was able to enter the police holding facility to interview Barona as hundreds gathered outside to demand the release of the detainees.
Today, the repression of the coup has exploded, but the resistance of the Honduran people has gotten stronger.
I think that President Manuel Zelaya should not negotiate anything. Everything that has happened until today is unconstitutional because the de facto president, Micheletti, is not the president of all Hondurans.
Throughout the coup which removed Manuel Zelaya from office, his return from exile, and the recent elections in Honduras, a reporter on the ground has been Tim Russo. Tim joins us now to reflect on the year's events. Tim, were there any points during the coup process where you could actually see how your reporting, the reporting of other members of the press, were actually affecting the chain of events, where information leaking out was altering the way things were transpiring during that chaotic period?
I think that there was really moments where both the police and the military didn't have the experience whatsoever to deal with the numbers of press and the international press, even independent media, that was sort of in its face, looking for answers, responding to human rights violations, responding to repression on the street or in the jails and that sort of thing. The way the press has been generally over the last 10, 15 years in Honduras is very, very controlled. There's a huge amount of violence. There's a lot of gang-related death. There's a lot of sort of just poverty-related death that takes place. And it's very common in the newspapers that generally what you see are photos that are just blood and gore of, you know, who's just been shot in whatever neighborhood in Tegucigalpa or in San Pedro Sula. And the police are used to the local media coming with their cameras and asking, show us the blood and gore. We're going to take images of that and we're going to report what you tell us. Now, that shifted tremendously during the coup because both the national press, a couple of media outlets, those that were most repressed, Radio Globo and Cholosat Sur, and then the international press were saying, we're saying this on the ground. We want to see the people that have just been arrested. We heard reports from the human rights organizations that you've arrested 100 people. We want to see where these people are. And myself as well, being able to get all the way into the interior of the police station and prove that people were arrested and not showing up on the official lists. We were able to save, what we believe, saved the life of Rafael Alegría, the leader of the Villa Campesina movement and one of the most outspoken people on the street with the resistance movement, after he had been picked up, arrested, and placed in solitary confinement. Had press not responded that particular day, this person could have been disappeared. So press, international press, was really able to kind of thwart certain activities of the government, and the government tried to respond to that then by controlling some of those spaces that they weren't prepared to control initially.
What about this past November's elections, which many believe were illegitimate? What do they mean for the near term in terms of the press for Honduras? Is there likely to be suppression of coverage critical to the incoming regime of Porfirio Lobo Sosa, who is also part of the opposition to Zelaya?
Yes, absolutely. We're going to see a couple of different communication strategies on the part of the new government. Pepe Lobo and his party, the National Party, they're very much tied to the ruling oligarchy as well. There's just a handful of people within the oligarchy, Larache, Ferrari, Rosenthal, and others, that are the owners of most of the multimedia, the TV, the cable television stations, the print newspapers. So I think what we'll see is on one side of things, trying to clean things up from the image that Micheletti has placed on the country as far as just outright presidential decrees that have limited freedom of speech and freedom of the press. I don't think we're going to have a decrees like that underneath of Pepe Lobo. He's going to try and stray away from that a bit, but at the same time, we're going to see really an application of the government with CONATEL, which is sort of the National Telecommunications Commission, to try and shut down media outlets that have been critical of the coup, critical in particular of the elections. It's a little bit more difficult to gag the international press, but of course, Honduras, after January 27th, when the new president comes in, we're going to see a lot less international press in the country. Then we're going to have sort of a gag of community media and that sort of thing. It's going to be very difficult for community radio stations to be more critical without the fear of being shut down or having their gear confiscated by the government.
Tim Russo is our correspondent in Honduras. Tim, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for all your great work this year.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be on there with Free Speech Radio News.
As the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan dragged on, 2009 also saw a significant increase in violence in northwest Pakistan. The area also became the newest front in the U.S. military's presence in the Muslim world. The Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and other militant groups have imposed Sharia law in some areas, banned female education, bombed numerous schools and markets, and generated a climate of fear for the people in the region. Many have fled. FSRN has been bringing you news from Pakistan all year long.
I was on a prayer mat when the shelling started. It was horrible. I have 3 sons left.
I'm worried about my parents and my siblings, who I left behind at my house. I came here with only my brother.
And now we have many problems here at the camp. We don't have food or shelter. My relatives died in the blast. I hear they are all under debris.
If they come and they will kidnap me, so I will cry and I will shout that please help me. And
do you think the people will come to you for help?
No, they will not come to help me because we are really afraid of Taliban in Sawat, and there is no one to talk.
That was some of the coverage we've brought you from Pakistan in 2009. A reporter in the area has been using a pseudonym because of the danger for journalists in the tribal areas. Joining me now is our correspondent. We've altered his voice for security reasons. Can you talk about some of the difficulties facing journalists like yourself, and how do you go about your job collecting information and interviews?
Andrea, it's very difficult to work in tribal area of Pakistan because of the many reasons. Taliban militants, if you report whatever they like, and if you follow whatever they order you or they convince you, then it is very easy to work. But on the other hand, then it is against the ethics of the journalism. The Pakistani government officials, they want every journalist to report whatever the government like, according to Pakistani government point of view. If you follow whatever the government says, then again the Taliban militants will be against you. And it is also against the ethics of the journalism. So difficult shapes in difficult circumstances. Also, it is very hard, extremely hard to work in tribal area because of the other reasons that the people, the common man, is not relying or they do not trust the journalist, because the journalist disclose their identity when they talk against the militants or when they talk against the government. The Pakistani people, especially the tribal peoples, are uneducated and they have heard a lot of rumors against the United States, and they believe that all United States citizens are cruel, and they mostly they avoid talking to the journalist working for US-based media. So keeping in view all these circumstances, it is very difficult to work for international media, especially for US media. But I'm from the tribal area, and my family is based in tribal area, and we are living there for hundreds of years. So I'm the part of that community, and they know my background, they know my parents, they know my family background, and they know me as a person. So that gives me a lot of support. They trust me. And whenever when I say that I will not disclose your identity, it means that I will not disclose. And the other thing that I know these militants leaders, we were classmates. We have studied in one school, in one classroom. So they know me also very well. And they believe that I will tell the truth, whatever the situation is. On the other side, if I will look to the government side, the government always pressurize people, especially they pressurize journalists, and they give bribes to media. They openly give monthly fee and monthly money to the journalist, and if you avoid that money to get that money, that creates a lot of problem for you. I faced a lot of problems last year. I was beaten harshly. I was threatened numerous times, and I was physically injured many times. My laptops, my cameras, and my equipments were destroyed many times. But trust me, I feel really comfortable. I feel comfortable because at the end of the day, I believe that I tell the truth to the world. And I will give you an example that most of the people who are tortured and who are extremely in harsh conditions, when I get my recorder and when I record their voices, they say, "We have burst our anger. We have burst our anger through your microphone and through your recorder," which is really consolable sentences, and which really, really makes me happy, and which really makes me comfortable.
I've been speaking with our correspondent in Pakistan. Thank you so much for all your great work this year, and please stay safe.
Thank you.
Today we've heard from just a few of our reporters around the world. In 2009, our correspondents broke through the walls of censorship and press restrictions in Afghanistan, Nigeria, Egypt, Mexico, Zimbabwe, and many other parts of the world. As a reporter-managed newscast, we'll continue to do so in 2010. Thanks to our listeners and donors who support this important work, and Happy New Year.
Today's special program, Press Freedom on the Frontlines, was produced by Andrew Stelzer and edited by Shannon Young. Scott Pham is our technical producer. You can hear the full extended interviews with our correspondents featured on this program on our website, fsrn.org. Tune in tomorrow for a special interview, One Voice at a Time, Reconciliation in the Middle East. That's tomorrow on Free Speech Radio News. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Thanks for listening.